And when you actually see people with so much courage and dignity, it's a very great privilege to have contact with people who are just so amazingly courageous, far-sighted, and are prepared to put their own feelings more or less into the firing line to hope that children will have a better history.
Welcome back to Her Story. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. We've made it to the end of season two, and before we go any further, thank you for listening this far. It's such a privilege and a pleasure to speak to these women and learn about the incredible things they've done. For our final episode this season, we meet Betsy Buchanan. Dr. Betsy Buchanan grew up in WA's great southern region of Noongarup, where from a young age, she was witness to extreme racial prejudice towards Indigenous Australians. Her deep respect and friendship with Noongar elders and families within the region, coupled with her support of her father, propelled her to study law at UWA and later become a social worker who would champion the rights of Aboriginal people. It's season 2, episode 12 of Her Story with Betsy Buchanan. This is Her Story.
Betsy Buchanan. I'm a legal and welfare advocate at Daydawn Advocacy.
We'll start off, I think, just by talking a little bit about your childhood. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell us where you grew up?
I grew up in the town of Noongarup, which right through my childhood and subsequently had a very bad history of racial prejudice. It was unfortunately quite notorious. The farmers were very affluent, and unfortunately also there was a large Noongar community. And I say unfortunately because they were crammed onto the reserve. Even though we lived in beautiful farmland, they found the most barren windset place for the reserve. It was tiny when you consider we had huge acres, and it was near the town rubbish tip, and it was overcrowded. So that was childhood.
So when you say reserve, other people might know that as a mission?
No, not a mission.
Can you tell
very
us the
different
difference?
Yeah, the native reserves were where they forced Aboriginal people to live because they'd moved them off the farmland, basically. And in Noongarup, there was a very large Noongar community because there was a huge natural spring there. And also it's close to what white people call the Stirling Ranges, so a very sacred area for them. And the missions were where they removed the children. We had both in Noongarup. We had a mission and we had the reserve, and they were right near our farm.
So from a really young age, you were very aware of the plight of First Nations people in the Great Southern region where you grew up.
Absolutely, because the reserve was adjacent to our farm. And although it was based on the Noongar people's spring, when they built the swimming pool, they locked the Aboriginal people out of the swimming pool. So they used to climb over the fence and swim in our dam. And also they worked on our farm from the time I can remember, always, both in the house as nannies and house helpers, and also on the farm.
What kind of year are we talking here?
Well, I was born in 1948, but that has continued really until very recently,
okay.
Until farmers no longer needed Noongar labourers. They still do need them for shearing, but they've tended to mechanise and discard the Noongar community, even though it's so sacred to them they would never leave.
I know this is probably an obvious question, but what was the public perception of Aboriginal people at the time of you growing up?
I don't know if it was the same everywhere else, but where I lived, they were barred from the swimming pool. They were barred from the picture theatre when it was established. They were barred from certain cafes, but they were totally essential for farm work. So, for example, we had a full Noongar shearing team. Couldn't possibly have worked as on a farm without them, but they weren't allowed to share amenities. So, and the reserve conditions were so extreme that their children got removed. And even though you can see the illogic of that, that they couldn't possibly improve their conditions while on a crowded reserve. They still removed the children because the conditions were bad. So they were in what you could almost call a horrendous situation.
The way that your family interacted with First Nations people, was that something that you think maybe later down the track influenced the work that you ended up doing?
Completely, because I think I've said publicly, both my parents were war veterans, and my mother in particular was extremely mentally unstable. So Aboriginal people showed immense kindness to me. But what used to really break my heart is that when it came to lunchtime, they weren't allowed into the house to eat. They were fed out the back door with the dogs, and I absolutely hated that because they'd been so kind to me as a little child. I found that very heartbreaking.
You're in that unique position of having that childlike perspective of seeing people for what they are, just human beings, and then seeing it translate into injustice.
They are exceptional people, Noongar people, and I think a lot of people who know their community and history will agree with me. They've got an almost unworldly kindness, so they could have hated me as this little privileged white child whose parents were being so completely inconsistent, relying on their labour and yet treating them like, you know, they had to be fed out the door with the dogs. But they showed immense kindness to me and it never wavered. And they were amazingly skilled workers. The farm depended on their skill and that was common with a lot of the farmers.
Tell me a bit about, Betsy, sort of your school life. Where did you go to school and how was high school for you?
Well, originally I went to the primary school and there had been a history of locking Aboriginal people out of the primary school and not letting them attend. And the Noongar people had to fight an enormous battle over that in a number of towns, but especially in Noengrup. By the time I went to primary school, the children had been allowed in, but they came from the reserve or the mission, so they're at extreme disadvantage. Even though a lot of them were really quite brilliant, the curriculum was so alien to them. When I turned 12, I went up to boarding school in Mount Lawley, Perth College. So that was what the farmers did normally. They removed their kids at high school and sent them to boarding schools. Then I lost the contact with Noongar people, which I found really quite traumatic.
What was the process of making that shift? I mean, growing up in the country in the great southern region of WA and then coming up here to Mount Lawley, that must have been quite a shock.
It was a shock. And of course, there were no Aboriginal people at the school. Now those schools do have some Aboriginal scholarships, but in our era it hadn't been thought of, although one lass came from Pinjarra, but I think she felt so ill at ease she ran away, and my heart was very much with her. But the school was an escape from me, from my mother's abuse. So in that way, I was privileged to go there because a lot of people who have abusive parents don't get sent to school like that. They get sent to orphanages and they don't have a privileged education.
Absolutely. Following on from high school, you start your university studies. You end up studying law at the University of Western Australia. Was there always the inkling that law was going to be the field that you were drawn to?
My father was a country party politician, and because I think of our home situation, he very much invested a lot of emotional energy in me, only because he couldn't really relate to my mother because she was so violent. And he wanted me to do law.
You complete your degree, you work as a graduate lawyer in the Crown Solicitor's Office. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, well, I worked in the probation and parole branch then. My father was dying at that time and he was very friendly with the head of that department. And I think I have to confess, although I did have the degree and everything, that he probably his influence got me the job because I wasn't a trained social worker and he was worried about what would happen to me when he died and my mother might continue abusing me. So going there, well, that's where I met my husband, which was an amazing joy to me. But also I found reading through the case files, I felt a profound identification with the people I was going to be supervising. And it was almost like a mirror as I read their sort of histories because they'd often had extreme abuse. I think it was a way of connecting that I hadn't really understood.
It's really interesting, this idea, and you've spoken about your mother a little bit, Betsy, and I don't want to wade into or make you relive anything that you're not comfortable with, but you're right, it is so profound, the comparison that you're able to draw
role between yourself, this educated person in a graduate job, and those of the cases that you're actually looking at and reflecting upon?
Well, it's interesting. One of the reports I did, the judge commented that, my, I think we called them clients then, who had reoffended, but he said to the judge he only wanted me, otherwise he wouldn't cooperate with probation. And the judge wrote to the director and said, I wonder why she feels this profound, they feel this profound connection with me. And I do honestly believe it was, of course, my abuse wasn't as extreme as more disadvantaged people, but it was pretty daily and constant, and it disturbed my perceptions, so that for some reason I felt a profound mirroring and connection with them, and a sense that I could try and give people hope, because often they used to be judged and written off. And I always knew that no matter how extreme your suffering, you can somehow transcend it if people believe in you and are kind to you. Like the Noongar people are, like I might not have survived physically without their kindness. So that was a brilliant model for me.
As much as love and hope are unifying factors, unfortunately, things like sadness and trauma are as well.
Childhood trauma is extremely hard to recover from. I think people minimise that. I think it was something to a great credit of Australia. They had the Royal Commission into Abuse. So I don't think hardly any country, maybe except Canada, has done such a good Royal Commission. And I think halfway through, the judge who was presiding over that suddenly saw that children do not really recover from abuse. And I think that's true. If I hadn't had Noongar people, I would never have recovered. I mean, I have bad disabilities, like I can't drive a car or go on a plane or go on a lift. Those abuse traumas still affect me, but I've been able to work with them. And I think that, again, is the profound mirroring from the Noongar people.
So when the judge writes to you about this one particular client, about only exclusively wanting to work with you, is that the moment when it became apparent that this exactly was where you were supposed to be, the thing that you were supposed to be doing is fighting for the rights of those First Nations people?
Yes, because I wasn't a trained social worker. As I said, I got the job, I think, basically through family connections, although I was all right at it. I don't think I disgraced anyone. But because I wasn't a trained social worker like my husband, I would have had to train in that. And I just had this incredible desire to meet up with Noongar people again and try and work with them. And the experience at probation and parole and having a law background, I thought that would be something that I could offer that I couldn't offer as a child, try and remedy some of the wrongs and hurts, because they were still very extreme in that era.
Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, once you leave the Crown Solicitor's Office, what were you doing next in your career?
I went and started my articles because I thought maybe I could work with the ALS. And the person I worked with was a lovely person and very sincere, but he'd had a background very like mine, except that he grew up in a different region. And he talked about when he saw the Noongar workers put in chains and taken to the Moore River settlement. But the way that he said it, we were not far from the Kelmscott Hills because he had a practice out there. And I looked up at the hills and I felt this incredible desire to leave and to go and try and work with Aboriginal people. I know that sounds too mystical for most people, but that's what I did. They were, a lot of them were homeless in Beaufort Park, and I went there, and Trades Hall gave us a basement office, and I set up the first law centre to try and like reach out to those people, because ALS was just dealing with criminal matters, but we were trying to deal with housing, with the actual homelessness and the removal of the children. Lawyers like Robert French and Fred Cheney, see, they, as they still have to do, have to deal with the enormous overrepresentation in the criminal law system, and they can't really address the social problems that cause it. I mean, they try and bring in law reform, but they can't fight for housing. That takes an enormous amount of...
It's almost like you said, there is that division between the criminal law aspect and then the actual economic and socio-emotional well-being and community housing aspect as well, the civil sort of aspect.
Well, I think underlying a lot of the offending is homelessness, but also underlying it is the terrible abuse that people suffered in orphanages and institutions, and that wrought such terrible damage that the combination of being homeless and having been abused makes it very hard for people to break out of that system. Their low self-esteem, the fact that when they had to leave farms, they had no proper training, lack of education, all those things contribute to that.
Tell me, when you were at the ALS, were you working or were you volunteering?
I never actually worked at the ALS. What we did is we set up a community law centre, which, I mean, I think they perhaps initially, or in the history of the ALS, they say that some of the lawyers did seem to resent the families coming to us. But the reason they came, I think, is partly because I'd grown up with a lot of the families, so that would have been a familiarity, but also because we focused very strongly on housing, which was their very pressing need, and also on trying to find where their children had been taken. And, you know, that was something, if you're doing criminal law at the ALS, you simply do not have the time.
Of course. Yeah. What kind of era are we talking at this point?
Yeah, well, I set up the Community Law Centre, 1978. I got a Commonwealth grant from Peter Durack, who was the Liberal Attorney General, but he had actually been a friend of my father's in the state parliament before he went to the federal parliament. And he came from that sort of rural privileged background, but relying a lot, the Durack family, on Aboriginal labour on the stations that they owned and everyone owned in the north. So he gave the money to set up the law centre because we were doing an outreach directly to the First Nations people, and it was quite a unique service.
What was the feedback at the time? I can't imagine there were many other services or outreaches like this to First Nations people. What was the reception like from, I guess, colonisers and then also from First Nations people?
First Nations people showed the amazing loyalty they've always showed in my experience, in that they'd line up for hours, they told their friends, their relatives, people would come up from the country. We got an amazing response from them. From officials and from colonial people, we got a most negative response. We were definitely very despised and rejected. I mean, my husband supported me incredibly. And if I hadn't had his support, see, I worked voluntarily and he supported me. And the reason I did that is that I was very influenced by the organisations in Germany and Japan that tried to redeem their behaviour during the Holocaust. And I felt that the conditions were not dissimilar, particularly the removal of children and the dreadful social conditions where people died in a most abject way. So to me, and my husband supported me in this very much, that the voluntary work was a way of trying to make a statement, maybe like Legacy, which is all voluntary, to try and show that the commitment. And a lot of Noongar people have said to me that they have really been conscious of that and appreciated that.
You mentioned that white folk had quite a dismissive, if not disgusted, sort of response.
Yeah, angry.
Why? What was the perception at the time? Why were people so outraged by this?
Outraged, yes, that's quite correct. Well, I suppose one thing is they didn't like me volunteering, and I think that because the feminist movement was strong there, I think a lot of people saw women as having been used as volunteers and worked for nothing, and there was a big push they should take money. I got a lot of pushback from feminist groups about that, and even feminist journalists who supported the office strongly but thought I should be paid. I suppose because my father had been a Member of Parliament, worked in Legacy, and my mother was so disturbed, I had probably a different outlook on life to a lot of people. And I knew realistically that if I got paid, I'd never be able to stand up for people properly, that there'd be such a pushback that the money would be removed. And we were lucky that Peter Durack stuck by us, actually, because we caused outrage initially.
It's quite a groundbreaking thing to be happening at the time, to let alone be funded or backed by somebody who was in quite a high precarious position.
Very eminent person, but I think that most people would agree he was an extremely principled man. I had known him, my father and he were friendly, so I was lucky, but I don't think in any way that influenced his decision. His decision would have been based on the fact that the park was full of Aboriginal people who are homeless, whose children had been removed, and he was the member for Perth. So, you know, he would have felt a very direct responsibility. And my experience of him, he was a person of very high ethical standards.
You mentioned that your father worked for Legacy. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, Legacy is where the children and families of people who have died in the war or been badly injured and damaged, the ex-servicemen look after them. My father was profoundly committed to Legacy. He held quite leading positions because he'd been a very acclaimed veteran. And the issue I took from Legacy is that they worked absolutely for nothing and that their help was absolutely non-judgmental. So that was a very profound lesson for me, not to judge, because I used to go around with my father on some of the Legacy rounds and some of the veterans behaved in a shocking way. But my father used to explain to me they'd had to do certain missions that traumatised them. And that gave me an understanding, which was so perfect, that trauma causes people to behave in that way. He always emphasised to me that Noongar people from his area, who he'd known also all his life, had fought overseas in the war and then were not recognised. And I think also what I admired about him, he had a terrible life at home because of my mother, but he still tried to serve his community. And I guess I got a model from him of to try and keep going, even though sometimes it was difficult.
So 1978, you opened the state's very first community law centre. There are now multiple of those, but let's go back to 78. It's you and your husband, and who else is around to start that particular service?
The trade union movement supported us, and then some of my law lecturers, Richard Harding and then Robert French, who had been with the ALS, served on our board. So although some of the ALS people resented our service, Robert French, with his quite brilliant mind, and he eventually became Chief Justice, saw that that was essential too and that we had that contact with the community. So we got support from them. And then my husband, who was lecturing in social work, quite a few of the students came and did placements there, and law students did as well. But we also tried to train Aboriginal people, and a lot of them who have now got prominent positions actually did their training there.
So it's that idea of this holistic community approach, but also instilling self-determination, which is a huge thing that we talk about still now to this day, instilling self-determination for First Nations people, allowing them to make the decisions and the calls on issues that define their lives.
I think that's probably where we got a lot of criticism, because my approach and philosophy was that we just listened. People came voluntarily, so they weren't forced to come. And they told us what they wanted us to do, and we would do it. And they kept saying, we want housing and we want to find our children. They led the vision of the office, without a doubt.
You just put your expertise into place.
I was lucky. I mean, I was by no means a very clever lawyer, but I had a lot of contacts, and that was through a privileged background and through law and through my husband, through social work. And he was also a strong Labor supporter, so the trade union movement supported him. And I think we put all that to use for people who were so excluded from the power structures. And I think that's what Mr. Drake wanted us to do, to try and combine those forces, to try and enable people to have the basis to obtain employment, reunify their families.
Tell me, how many people are coming to the legal centre every day? How many people are you able to see, and how many were lining up out the door?
There would be dozens every day. We have to restrict people a bit to cope with the complexity of the issues, but we don't insist on appointments, and we have a completely accepting system where if we can't fit people in, we get them to come back another day and promise that they'll be seen. And we very much have tried to follow that model of we don't coerce people into appointments or force them. We leave it if they can cope and if they want to come.
When you first started the centre, did you know what would happen in the years to come? I mean, since that started in the 1970s, the late 1970s, there are now dozens of community legal centres across WA. Did you know that was going to happen?
Had no idea, but a lot of the lawyers push for that. The Law Society in WA very much back community legal centres, and there's specialist services like tenancy, and then there's also locations like Murdoch University run one in Kwinana, Rockingham. There's a centre out in Armidale that lawyers can't really, even through legal aid or free legal services, you do need specialised services. Even then, they can't really stem the tide of homelessness, really. But, I mean, we do try.
How does it make you feel knowing that this thing that you started in the 1970s, just based on the fact that it was the right thing to do, how does it make you feel to see where it's at now?
When I felt very profoundly grateful about it was when I gave a speech at a conference recently where there were some First Nation people there, and one of the men who has a very good job now got up and said to me that he believed that Noongar women would not really have worked with white people nearly as well if it hadn't been for that legal office. And I thought that was probably the most profound compliment that you could ever receive. He said he thought it had had enormous significance because of its probably pioneering role and the fact that he came from a family who'd been through that trauma, knew what it meant. He said particularly to the women, and he said the women needed their kids back and they needed shelter, and he felt it had played an enormous role. So his evaluation made me feel very, very proud and grateful.
It's not just that it was the right thing for you to do then, I guess. It's because it was just ingrained in you as a small child. You grew up having Aboriginal nannies. You grew up with them working on the farm, seeing them in your own community, living across the road, your dad at war with them as well. So it's not even just a matter of it being the right thing to do. It was just you really didn't know any different.
No, it's the social circumstances, and also some of the elders from that area, the women call me our girl, and that's their way of saying we chose you and we trusted you. I found that profoundly moving too. Elder who's recently died, she at her funeral, they said something to one of her daughters that someone they knew was their mum's favourite, and she said, Betsy was mum's girl, and she always knew she'd come and work with us. So they have that very profound concept of time and of community, and they believe that if you've been part of their community, it's sort of in a way not expected, but part of their dreaming, if you like, that you grew up with them, they knew you, and your heart was with them. And they seemed to know that. They never showed anger to me, even though there would have been reason to, because of what had happened in Noongar.
I want to ask you, Betsy, was there ever a point or was there ever a day when you woke up and you thought, I've just listened to so much heartache, I've just listened to so much trauma, and I need a minute to not think about this. Was there ever a really challenging time where you thought, is this the right thing?
I think when I worked with the Aboriginal Medical Service and a lot of families came forward about having been abused, not in institutions, but by family members who, being in institution, had really affected badly and they abused family members. I found that very, very traumatic because I had that feeling, should I really be doing this? Is this really my right role? But because the Aboriginal Medical Service was basically directed by Professor Ted Wilkes, I went and spoke to him, and he said, look, we've made the decision that Aboriginal children and mothers will not come forward to their own people because of the difficulties within families, and that they have to have an outside person. And he put it to me, we've come to that decision very reluctantly, but we feel that you have to play that role because we don't think people will come forward otherwise.
You were their girl.
That's right. I could tell in almost it hurt him a bit, but he said, look, they accept you and they won't talk to us, some of the children, because they're scared of what might happen. Of course, he backed us very, very strongly, and a lot of the Aboriginal leadership did, but you have to make the first step forward, and it's so hard for abuse victims to come forward. It's so frightening and, you know, traumatic.
Completely. The Aboriginal Medical Service, which was later changed to the Dhirubhul Yerrigan Health Service, doing some incredible work. And like you said, you would have experienced and heard firsthand some accounts, absolutely devastating. Were there people looking out for you at the time as well?
Possibly not. And I think the reason there is because, as Professor Wilkes used to say, you can divide our staff into those who were taken and those who weren't. He felt that people who were taken were struggling with so much trauma of their own. And in particular, he pointed out that they couldn't really support the abused kids because a lot of them were not concealing their own abuse, but just unable to deal with it. And it wasn't all that acceptable then until the Royal Commission, really, although he was very aware of it. And I think the thing is, if you see what the families go through, it's so extreme, and it still is so extreme. They cope with deaths in custody, suicides, inherited trauma, homelessness. You can't draw on different philosophy rather than, I know that that's the psychological issue now, that carers have to look after carers or whatever that is. But I think the thing is, you just have to accept that the community have had such extreme trauma. I always drew a lot on my husband and also religious belief about God's purpose in history, that eventually the issues that needed to come out would come out and be healed.
Which I guess is where the Royal Commission to Deaths in Custody intended to go. You worked a bit on this. What was your involvement?
We did something like 800 submissions on a voluntary basis. And again, the same thing happened. There were a lot of paid services, multiple paid services. The people came in to us, and I don't think it was because in that instance it was voluntary. I think it's because I knew the people well, and already I had a very good consciousness of how much abuse they'd suffered. Even so, it was incredibly difficult for the men to come forward. They showed immense courage, and initially the Royal Commission had no idea of compensation. So they came forward to prevent other children from going through what they'd gone through. And when you actually see people with so much courage and dignity, it's a very great privilege to have contact with people who are just so amazingly courageous, far-sighted, and are prepared to put their own feelings more or less into the firing line to hope that children will have a better history.
Mm. Yeah. We look at Aboriginal deaths in custody. In recent years, obviously last year, there was a huge focus back on that, as WA becoming one of the largest states with the most deaths in custody. How are you feeling about the state of that? I mean, you've worked on the actual Royal Commission. Are you feeling like enough of it was implemented, or is there still far too much to do?
Far too much to do. I mean, a lot of the recommendations haven't been implemented. Housing is the most profound issue. If they would work on housing and put some money into that, I think they could prevent a lot of the imprisonment. But also the trauma a lot of those families have been through causes imprisonment. Unfortunately, I was well aware of an era of Aboriginal men who were in prison when they're only 15 in adult prisons and were subject to the most horrific abuse. And that's caused a lot of intergenerational damage, and I think it still leads to deaths in custody. I think the community would have to face up to the extremity of what's been implemented in those policies, particularly imprisoning those young men who were then subject to predatory behaviour and grew up with such terrible bitterness.
We've seen even just in recent years the government choosing to not raise the age of criminal responsibility as well. And from what you've been saying, Betsy, is this is all linked. Homelessness and the issue of housing and the housing crisis directly relates and responds to trauma and crime and incarceration and then death.
Absolutely. From my experience of Aboriginal people, I do not feel, except in exceptional cases, that they are criminals. They wish very much to change what is happening in their society, their own families. And I know on the surface that may not seem right, but when you talk to Aboriginal men who've been in prison, they're so profoundly traumatised that they can't be role models for their children. And that gives them motivation, but often they are released homeless and they feel such a loss of self-esteem. I do believe that there's very deep-seated racism in every single political party in WA. It's not by any means just Liberals, National Party. I believe everyone, Greens and Labor, carry that probably unconscious racism, and they could change radically if I think they need to work on their own attitudes. I often find when I try and advocate for Aboriginal people that I still get extreme hostility, and that's often from surprising political sources. I think really the parties need to do a lot of consciousness raising about their own attitude to racism, particularly to the Noongar people who have been so oppressed and exploited. And I don't think parties really recognise that, like me, their success depends so much on their exploitation.
I just want to change pace for a moment. I want to go back to the early 2000s when you completed your PhD. You completed your doctorate in 2006. What was that in?
Well, that's not really, that's an honorary doctorate. So it wasn't based on academic work. It was based on the decades of voluntary work. It's awarded to people who work on a voluntary basis with First Nations people. And the other recipient was a woman who belonged to that group I referred to before of German people who wanted to redeem the Holocaust. She was a Palatine nun who made a conscious decision to work in Africa, and she built hundreds of schools. So the whole philosophy of that is people who would not be recognised generally, but who work over a long period trying to act as an act of reparation. So it's not seen as a career thing. It's not seen as anything that you do for money. It's seen as a conscious attempt to redeem history and to acknowledge it and to try and make some difference. So I feel proud of that, even though it's not an academic achievement.
When you received this honorary PhD, was it a moment of solidifying from that academic realm what you were doing?
I felt enormous gratitude in the sense that since I was a very small child, I'd been reading about these groups who try and redeem the Holocaust. And I was very sort of focused on it. At law school, I read a lot about the Nuremberg trial, and that it seemed like what the Noongar people had said to me, that you're our girl, that nun seemed to exemplify what I was trying to get at. I mean, she'd built, I think it was 450 schools. She was about 90, I think. But she said in her speech that we can't ever really redeem what we did to minorities, but we have to show that we are repentant and that we don't want it to happen again. And I think, you know, probably that's what I mean about the political parties here. I don't think we take our history with the seriousness that we should. Like, I think a lot more consciousness raising needs to be done about what we have actually done to build this state.
So Australia hasn't quite fully reckoned with its history, so there's no way we could possibly pave a better way forward without fully understanding what's actually happened.
Well, that's what our First Nations people said at the Uluru Statement from the Heart. They wanted truth where their history is acknowledged. I mean, that is coming from them. And I can see the absolute blessing of that, in the sense that when you speak to First Nations people, they have that amazing honesty and integrity. I mean, just an example of that, a young Noongar man, when I felt doubtful about the Royal Commission and the work I was doing early on, he said to me, "Look, Betsy, as far as I see it, child abuse is like a weapon of mass destruction." And I've always been very struck by their profound grasp of morality. And I think it is not money or it is not bitterness. It's justice for them. They want it acknowledged because, you know, a lot of the people say to me, well, they say Australia's built on the sheep's back, but it's really built on First Nations people's back. And to me, that is so accurate.
A saying that I see pop up from time to time, particularly around January 26, is White Australia has a black history, which I think resonates a lot with me, but I hope with a lot of other people as well.
I think young people are very different, and that's where I feel a great deal of hope. I've found young people, for one thing, I think they've had the benefit of institutions like the Royal Commission, where they've seen the injustice laid out. They don't try and deny child abuse. They're very conscious of childhood trauma. And I think that changes them profoundly as human beings, that young people are very much more enlightened in that area. And I think there's a lot of hope.
It's really good to hear that from you, Betsy. I mean, you've worked your entire life in this field and in this career and really just advocating for the rights of First Nations people. So to start in that journey with distaste and sort of rejection from white folk to seeing where it's at now, do you breathe a little bit easier knowing that the next sort of generations of lawmakers and just general population are at least aware or willing to not sweep it under the rug as much?
I think young people have been amazing in that one area of prejudice they've very much overcome is prejudice towards same-sex attracted people. The only thing that I feel sad about there is that I wish that movement could transmute into working with First Nations people, because they have also suffered that same fear, discrimination, hiding their real feelings, frightened of the police, frightened of violence. So they've got a lot that they can give in that area. And I think young people have done an amazing job there to overcome what was a pretty shocking violence
in the history.
In the history, like being pushed over cliffs. And it's very like Aboriginal people, you feel so vulnerable and that the law does not protect you. So I think if we can draw on that movement, and I think young people are the ones to lead the way there.
We'll lead the way now, but take the reins only from people like yourself, Betsy. And I mean, you've been recognised for your contributions in these areas of advocacy in many ways, so many different awards that you have been afforded for your work over the last few decades. One of them, which came this year, was you received an OIM, this year's Queen's Birthday Honours List. What was that experience like?
Well, I must say it was a bit of a shock, because I know when I've had articles about me in the paper, I heard from one of my friends who worked in the housing department that the staff threw darts at the picture. So I wasn't used to being that respectable.
What?
Yeah.
Throwing darts at your picture?
Because I was such a nuisance.
Oh, because you challenged people.
Very much so. And they absolutely loathed me. And I don't think it's really changed. But that award was given on the recommendation of Aboriginal people. So it's extremely precious to me, because I did find that out, that they pushed for it and they put the submissions in. So that makes it so precious.
It even more so is like a validating and an overwhelming thank you sort of sense from Aboriginal people.
Well, people have said to me, it must be hard to work for nothing. But you see, when you know Aboriginal people, you don't work for nothing. You know, what they give back is so priceless. And one thing that they give back is the way they thank you, which is unique and so beautiful. And it just makes you feel every day was worthwhile. And I don't think that many people have that privilege to think that about their lives. You know, they give you so much more than you could ever imagine.
The other award, of course, that we have to touch on is your induction into the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. That came in 2017, a few years prior. What was it like getting that email or that phone call to say we'd like to induct you?
Well, actually, I was very pleased about that, because I was under terrible pressure at that time, both for the action I'd taken about trying to bring forward the issues of child abuse and also opposing eviction. So I was very much on the back foot and felt under siege. And that was really a very amazing award. I felt like it projected me into a safer area, and I was terribly thrilled, because I think all the various people who received that award, I felt on the night, there were people who the community know, but there were lots of people who the community were not aware of. And one of the most important people there who sat near me, of course I won't name her, she said to me, She's a very powerful person. She said to me, "I've heard so many terrible things about you, Betsy. I'm so pleased to meet you. You're not like I thought." And I thought, I think that's what the Women's Hall of Fame did for me.
That boosted your profile.
In a positive way, not having darts thrown at me. I think she knew about the dart. People thought it was funny. I can't say I did, really.
No.
But I suppose I found it very threatening. But then other people, or my husband, definitely comforted me and said, "Look, you must be doing something right if people are that annoyed." But even with this very lovely, important person at the Hall of Fame, she said, "I've heard the most terrible things about you." So, I mean, that sort of confirmed to me that I was treading on toes a lot. And probably still do.
And doing the right thing.
Hopefully. Yeah, hopefully.
What are you doing with yourself now, Betsy? Where do you see yourself day to day now?
I still love to work with our First Nations people. I mean, they are forging ahead in so many different directions. Statement from the Heart being one, their literature, their art. Marvis Noongar singer Gina Williams, who got the Order of Australia, same honours list. She sings in Noongar. Her family partly come from Noongarup. They're very transformative, miraculous changes. And I suppose, you know, I have to feel that our prayers of God's purpose in history have been fulfilled in a way that people are gradually coming out of the horror of their backgrounds and making an incredibly positive contribution to society.
Much the same as that contribution that you have been making. Before we wrap up, Betsy, the name of this podcast is Herstory. It's a play on the word history. Obviously, looking at the women who've been inducted in the Hall of Fame, is Herstory a word that you've heard before?
I suppose I had an ambivalence about feminism because I did receive so much violence from my mother. It's always been a very hard thing for me because, like all children who've been through those experiences, I had a terror that I would behave that way. And we've never been able to have children because of that. So I guess I felt ambivalence, but when I had the induction into the Hall of Fame, I felt very differently because it was such a diverse contribution, not based strictly on feminist theory, but just on women being able to contribute in areas they had not been recognised. Mm. So I suppose in that way, I found it very reconciling.
It's really lovely to hear that maybe your own perception of your own history or your own herstory has also changed over time.
Very much so, in the sense I'm aware that women who are so-called mad is partly caused by social conditions. And my mother was a war veteran, so there was a big element of post-traumatic stress. And also her nihilism about children because she'd seen so much death and destruction. That's understandable, but as a child you can't grasp it. But I think, especially in the night of the Hall of Fame, when I listened to everyone's stories, I did feel quite reconciled because I thought it'd been a tough struggle for women to even participate. So I felt that that was a reconciling.
Thank you so much for your time. Thanks to Betsy Buchanan and all of the women at the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Whadjuk Noongar Boodja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Thank you for joining us in Season 2 of Herstory. All episodes from both seasons are available for you to revisit at rtrfm.com.au. I'll catch you for Season 3 soon.
Song Lions is a new RTRFM podcast shining a light on First Nations artists across WA. Join me, Cesara Krishnaz, as I sit down with creatives across music, theatre, dance and television, paving the way for the next generation of storytellers. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.